All right. Well, good morning, friends. Good morning. If we haven't met yet, my name is Dan. I have the privilege of serving here as the teaching pastor for LifePoint Worthington. Really grateful that you are here with us today. Hey, if this is your first time here, let me explain just a couple things of what we're doing and why the lobby smells like a movie theater when you walked in. And please keep eating your popcorn. Doesn't bug me at all. Couple things. What we're trying to do over the last couple weeks is we want to look at movies that have come out in the last year or so and kind of ask the question, what story are these movies telling? Right? And the posture isn't to say, like, you know, be combative or overly critiquing of these stories. We want to look at these stories and say, like, what is true about them? Why are they true? Why do they move us? And what we've been coming to week after week is that there is something about stories that can point to a true and better story. So that's what we've wanted to explore over the last few weeks. So we got popcorn, we got candy, the trailer. It's a whole vibe every week as we are doing this. But I want you to think about it this way. Stories are powerful. Stories are powerful. Good stories are powerful. We love to get lost in them and watch them. But there is a big difference between being lost in a story and understanding what that story is doing to us. Understanding, why does it pull me? Why does it make me feel a certain kind of way? It kind of sneaks past some of our theological imagination, our political imagination, and kind of gets to the heart in ways that like just a lecture can't always do. And so that's what we are wrestling through this series. Now, I will add this one more caveat. What we're doing right now with me standing up here and sharing, like, I think this is not the most helpful approach to dissect movies and understand the stories. Really, what we need to be doing is sitting down around a table and with some coffee, tea, or whatever, like having a discussion, having a dialogue, because what I'm going to share is like my thoughts, what I think the scriptures say, what they teach, but you're going to have your own ideas. We would like to dialogue back and forth. So to that end, we want to make an opportunity available for you to ask any other questions that come up from what we talk about today. If you scan that QR code on the seat right in front of you, you'll be taken to lpguest.com. You can open the Worthington Notes app there. And in the Notes app, feel free, post questions, ask questions. You are going to have pushback on some of the things that we talk about today. That's okay. I welcome that. We want to wrestle with these hard things together. All right. Now, let's get to Superman. How many of you saw the movie? This movie, okay. I'm not a very controversial guy. This is the best superhero movie ever made, okay? I absolutely loved this new iteration of Superman. It's in the popular imagination, like Superman, right, is this incorruptible icon of truth and justice. And more than that, like anyone like a big Superman lore, like you know all of the backstory, anybody like that? Okay, no nerds here. Awesome. Great. If you've been tracking with any of his story, I mean, Superman originally appeared in the world around 1930. The first comics showed up then. His story, since the beginning, has been dripping with all kinds of Christian imagery. I mean, just think about the grand narrative of the Superman storyline. I mean, he is sent to Earth by a benevolent God, his father, so that he can show people the way of truth and justice. He is sent to serve and to guide and to save. I mean, that has been the story arc for almost every other Superman movie that we have watched. But this new iteration that we just saw the trailer for is different. This is not the normal Superman. In fact, in the opening sequence of the movie, this invincible Superman, he loses a fight, his first fight. You actually find him, you first see him laying in a heap, beat up and bloody. Even more than that, this version of Superman finds out, along with the rest of the world, that despite what he has always believed about himself, that his parents sent him to serve and save humanity, that he's actually been sent there to do something different. He's been sent to conquer and subdue. The idea that humanity is a weak species and can easily be ruled by him, his father says, and you can expand and restore our ancestral kingdom. Like, that's kind of the premise of the movie, is his entire script of what he thought he knew about himself has been turned upside down, and Superman in the film is absolutely paralyzed by this revelation. You think about it this way. Biologically, Superman is a god. He's got a mandate to conquer and subdue, and he can do it. He can do it. But there's this other part of him that he wrestles with in the film. I mean, experientially, he's lived the last 27 years as a farm kid from Kansas. He's a son. He's a friend. He's a neighbor. And this mandate that he finally understands from his parents, not only does it not fit what he's always thought about himself, it is the antithesis of everything he believes he is supposed to do in this life. And so for the rest of the movie, almost everybody else sees him not as the hero they wanted. They see him as a villain. He's not the protector. He is the one humanity needs protection from. And so the tension that kind of weaves its way through the whole film is this simple question. How do I know who I really am? How do I know who I really am? You see, I think that that is actually a really profound question. You can hear the tension in that question, because this is not something we just like casually open up and talk about. This is the haunting question that despite copious amounts of magnesium or whatever magic potions were taken at night, still wakes us up at 3 a.m. How do I know who I am? This is the question we ask when the script that we've been handed in this life stops making sense. When the job title is stripped away, when the marriage ends, when the kids leave, when the thing that used to make you feel secure and super and safe is gone. Who am I then? And friends, if you resonate with that question at all, then I think you're ready to join me in the story we're going to be looking at today. I mean, this is going to feel like a hard pivot for a moment. I promise we're going somewhere with this. If you have a Bible with you, why don't you open up to the New Testament book of Luke? The New Testament book of Luke, we will be in chapter 10, starting in verse 25 today. Luke chapter 10, starting in verse 25. It's a very familiar story from Jesus. Just to set the scene a little bit, Jesus has been traveling around this with this small but growing band of followers. And along the way, he has developed a reputation as a very unconventional thinker. And so from time to time, he would have people who approach him with questions. Sometimes the questions are very genuine, like they're trying to wrestle with stuff. Sometimes there's something else hiding behind the question. And that's what happens here. Luke chapter 10, starting in verse 15. You can see it on the screen behind me as well. Says this, and behold, a lawyer stood up and put him to the test, saying, "Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" And he said to him, "What is written in the law? How do you read it?" The lawyer answered, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, with all your strength and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." And Jesus said to him, "You have answered correctly. Do this, and you will live." Now, pause there for a second. What is this lawyer actually asking Jesus? You can go back and look at the question for a second. What shall I do to inherit eternal life? See, like our modern ears, which have been formed by, Christendom over the last 2,000 years, like we hear a question about the afterlife. We hear something a bit more like, "Jesus, how do I make sure I go to heaven when I die?" But we have to remember that when we're looking at the Gospel of Luke, we're actually looking at a first century document. We're looking at a document that was written to people who are very far removed from our modern context. They were asking very different kinds of questions, and they were not interested in asking about floating around in the clouds somewhere after death. You see, in the first century, the Jewish people believed that history was going to be divided into two very distinct eras. There was the present age, which was dark and broken and ruled by the enemies of God's people, and that's where they're living right now under the rule and reign of Rome. And then there was the age to come. Sometimes they would talk about this as eternal life or the life to come. And it was the moment when God would return to kick out darkness and establish his kingdom right here on earth. And he's asking a different kind of question. Notice the word that he uses. He says, "Teacher, what shall I do to inherit this?" You don't earn an inheritance. You don't buy an inheritance. You receive an inheritance based on who you are. You receive it because of your family name. You see, what he is asking Jesus is not like an eternity question. This is an identity question. He wants to know, how can I be sure, teacher, that I will have a seat at the table in the age to come? Will I get to join in subduing God's enemies? Because in Jesus' day, the expectation was not that God would initiate his kingdom with peace. Everybody was expecting him to do that with a sword. They were waiting for a Messiah who would slay the enemies and invite God's people to rule and reign along with him. That was the expectation. And so, what shall I do to inherit eternal life isn't how do I get saved? It's how do I prove that I'm in? And how do I know? Like, what do I have to do to know for sure that I'm in? How do I get my badge? That brings us to the lawyer's follow-up question, because when Jesus confirms that it's love God and love your neighbor, the lawyer isn't satisfied. Look at verse 29. But he, desiring to justify himself, said to Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" He wants certainty. Like, he's asking about which boxes he needs to check. Who, Jesus, specifically is my neighbor? And to that question, Jesus gives not just a story, but an identity test. Actually, he gives a way to answer the question, how do I know who I am? Look with me, starting at verse 30. Jesus replied, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers, who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. Now, by chance, a priest was going down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, he too passed by on the other side." Now, I'm willing to bet in a room like this, there's a level of familiarity with the details of this story. Right, but I want us to hear this the way any first century audience would have heard it. Right, there's some insider language and knowledge that they knew that as we look at that, I think some of the details are going to pop in a way for us that we are not accustomed to. Here's the first thing we need to know. As Jesus tells this story to the original audience, this is a very familiar story. This is a pattern. This is a trope. It's like he's starting it with like, hey, three men walk into a bar, right? Like that's kind of the flow of the story Jesus leans into. And from the beginning, the lawyer and anybody listening to this story would have at least thought that they could finish this story for Jesus without him having to even continue on. See, Jewish storytelling often relied on what's called the rule of three. Society was essentially a theocracy. It was divided into three, very clear, a three-part hierarchy. You had the priestly class. These are all the spiritual elite. You had the Levite class. These are the religious assistants. And then you had the common folks. You had the Israelites kind of at the bottom of that hierarchy. Now, remember, in Luke chapter 10, who approaches Jesus? It's this lawyer. And he's the one who's asking these questions. Now, we don't have time to get into this, but for a whole bunch of different socio-political reasons, this lawyer would not have identified as someone at the top tier. He would have identified with someone at the bottom tier, the common Israelites. And so when Jesus starts this story, a priest comes by and passes to the other side. The lawyer thinks to himself, of course, typical priest. Probably got to go meet someone for coffee, work on his blog, and start a podcast. When a Levite comes by, passes to the other side, the Levite figure, or the lawyer figure, you know, just thinks the figures, he's just going to do whatever the priest is doing. And now he's leaning in. He's ready for the punchline of the story. He knows who is coming next. He's waiting for that third tier, the common Israelite. He's waiting for the regular Joe to step in, save the day, shame the corrupt leadership at the top. I mean, he's waiting for a hero who's in just like him. So he can identify with that hero and say, that's me. I guess I'm good. Look at verse 33. But a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion. He went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he set him on his own animal and brought him to an inn and took care of him. And the next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper, saying, take care of him. Whatever more you spend, I will repay you when I come back. And we're not there, but I could imagine in that moment you could hear a pin drop. Breaks the pattern. It's not a common Israelite who shows up, but a Samaritan. And I get it. Like that doesn't hit for us very hard at all. Or like we don't feel anything when we hear that detail. Some of that is because we're just maybe used to this story. But to the lawyer, the Samaritan like isn't some neutral other category. He's not a neutral character. See, to the original audience, Samaritans, they weren't just like people who lived on the other side of the town or who were just a little bit different or off. I mean, there was a deep, century-old racial, political, and religious hostility between Jews and Samaritans. I mean, they viewed each other as entirely corrupt. I mean, to the lawyer, a Samaritan was the absolute last person on earth you could ever expect to be considered righteous or have compassion. I mean, he is the ultimate outsider. This is a villain. This is a heretic. This is the enemy. I mean, it'd be like if we were watching a World War II movie right now, then the American soldiers run away and the hero steps up wearing a German uniform. Or maybe this will help. Maybe this will help us hear it the way that the lawyer would have heard it. Ignore the chronology issue for a second, but this would be like if Jesus was talking about a priest, a Levite, and a Muslim. That twinge or whatever you just felt in that is what the Levite was feeling. That doesn't fit. And that's part of why this story is actually far more provocative than this like cute, be a nice person spin it often gets. Jesus knows exactly what he is doing here. By design, there is something so backwards, wonderfully backwards about this story. And the lawyer is paralyzed by this. Look at the way the whole thing wraps up. And this is like a mic drop moment for Jesus. Verse 36, he says, which of these three do you think proved to be the neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers? Which of these three proved that he was in? The lawyer said, the one who showed him mercy. I think it's a masterful question from Jesus, which one became the neighbor? And you're looking closely at the passage. You notice the lawyer doesn't even use the word Samaritan. He can't even bring himself to say it. But the neighbor was the one with the wrong biology, the wrong theology, the one without the inheritance. And if you put all of this together, this whole thing started with a question about how do I know who I am? How do I know if I'm on the right side? Jesus' really wild answer to this question is that the true neighbor, the one who's in, is the one who acts like a neighbor. The one who acts like a neighbor. Now, pause here for a second. I'm going to guess that for the last few minutes, many of you have been thinking something along the lines of, what does the story about a first century Samaritan have to do with Superman? How do these things go together? Promise, I've been going somewhere with this. You see, I think in a lot of ways, both these stories expose a false way that we are often tempted by, a false way of answering the question, how do I know who I am? Both these stories wrestle with it. You see, the lawyer had a very specific way of answering that question. He believed, and I think, if we're honest, many of us believe too, that identity, how we answer that question, how do I know who I am, is that we can look at the labels we wear, and that's the answer. We think or live as if identity is a noun. It's a thing that we are because of the label we wear, the badge we wear. Identity is a label we wear that makes us feel safe and understood. It's the label that we look for in someone else to understand the other or at least try and make sense of how they could possibly live the way that they do. And in fact, labels are all over this story when you look for it. But there's a lawyer, there's a teacher, there's a priest, there's a Levite, there's a Samaritan. This is all over the place. And if we are honest, I think with ourselves, we do the exact same thing today because we love labels. They help us make sense of things. We cling to them because labels actually make us feel very safe. They tell us who we are without having us actually do anything. We might say, I'm a conservative, or I'm a progressive, or I'm white collar, or I'm blue collar. And these aren't just descriptions for us. They become, in a sense, like a fortress for us. We can hide inside of them. We can use them to draw a very clear circle, a boundary line of who is in, who is my neighbor, who is in, and who is out. You see, the lawyer thought that his identity was defined by his ancestry. And that is very clear in the question that he asks. This was his label. He believed that because he was a son of Abraham, his inheritance, his seat at the table, the reason he's in, is guaranteed because of what he is. He just wants Jesus to give him a few check boxes so that he can make sure his position is secure. The same thing is happening in the Superman movie. Superman is told by his parents, he's told his identity is defined by his biology, by his family of origin. Both of them, this lawyer, Superman, I mean, they're handed a script that says you are defined by what you are. But the reason this story is so provocative is because Jesus is saying something else. He's saying something that I think is far more radical. Again, this is why I said that this is the wrong format for a talk like this. We should be sitting down at a coffee table having a discussion back and forth because there's some, Dan, what about this? What about that? We need that type of discussion. But Jesus says something far more radical. See, he's saying my identity, your identity, is not just this static noun, it's not just a label you can throw around and wear like a badge of honor. Identity is not just status or background or ideology. Identity, at least a critical component of it, is all caught up in how we live, what we do. Listen, I'm walking a fine line here. I'm very aware of that. I'll be perfectly honest. Jesus' teaching that identity is about how we live is actually, I think, is deeply challenging to us in the current cultural moment that we are in today. It's deeply challenging to me, and I think especially so for those of us who would say we are followers of Jesus. Think about the story we typically believe about our relationship with God, our current cultural moment. In the modern Western American church, there is something about the way that we understand a relationship with God that tends to make us allergic to anything that sounds like we are what we do. Right? And you have to admit, it kind of sounds like that's where Jesus is going with this. For those of us who've grown up in the church or around the church, this can sound a little dangerous. It may or probably is already triggering some theological alarm bells. We hear this and we think it's a short line. Wait, are you saying that I have to earn my salvation? Are you saying that I have to work my way into God's family by helping enough people in the side of the ditch? No, that's not what I'm saying. The full arc of the Christian story is that we are invited into the family of God, not because of what we accomplish, not because of the labels that we wear, not because of what we do, not because of how many people we help on the side of the road, but by virtue of our relationship to, our allegiance to Jesus. That's it. Right? And that means anyone is welcomed in through faith in Jesus, through allegiance to Jesus. But I think a lot of times, this is where things slow down. For a whole bunch of reasons. Like we have produced a kind of Christianity that says, now that we're in, we're done. Modern Christianity tends to treat the gospel like a ticket. We think, okay, I've said the prayer. I have believed the right things. I have my ticket to heaven. Now I need to sit in the waiting room and try not to lose my ticket until the bus comes. But you see, Jesus was not inviting us into a waiting room. He is inviting us into a way of life. He isn't just giving us a new status. He is giving us a new nature for how we live and move and be in the world which he has placed us. You see, the danger isn't thinking that we are what we do. The danger is thinking that we can be something without ever doing anything at all. My favorite authors and thinkers, Dallas Willard, who was a longtime professor of philosophy at USC, he said it this way: grace is not opposed to effort. It is opposed to earning. Look at that again. Grace is not opposed to effort. It is opposed to earning. Maybe it's helpful to think about it this way. Think about the question, are you married? And this works if you're single, whatever your status is. Just think about that question. Are you married? What is someone trying to ask if they ask that question? I mean, technically, that's a noun. It's a status. You have a license, it's a thing, you have a ring, you have a wedding date. You don't have to earn your marriage every morning. You wake up married. If you're married, you wake up that way, you are a spouse. But can you really separate the noun from the verb? Like if you have a ring and the license, but you never speak to your spouse, you never serve them, you never sacrifice for them, you never really talk with them or engage with them, do you really have a marriage? Or do you have a piece of paper? See, marriage is a status defined by action. You cannot have one without the other. And this is exactly where the lawyer was lost. He was standing there, like waving this certificate in front of Jesus. He's saying, look, I've got the receipts. I'm a son of Abraham. I've got all of the stuff, the circumcision, the theology. I have the ring. He thought the status, the label was enough. He thought the paper proved who he was. But Jesus tells him a story about a priest who had the ring, who had the robes, the title, and the position, who had all of that and more. But when the moment of truth came, the moment he to actually live out that identity, he walked away. He had the title. He did not have the compassion. Jesus tells him the story of this Samaritan, man who doesn't have the ring, who didn't have the certificate, who didn't have the status, but he stopped. A man who served, a man who sacrificed. He didn't have the title, but he had the work. And Jesus looks at this lawyer. The whole conversation comes to a close. And he says, go and do likewise. Notice what Jesus doesn't do here. He doesn't give a whole list of application for this lawyer. Go specifically and do these things, these three things, and then come back next week and I'll give you three more things. He doesn't give him a new label to hide behind. He actually leaves this tension unresolved. And I want to be honest with you. Today, I am intentionally going to leave a tension unresolved for us. I'm not going to answer the question, what does this look like for us to go and do this? Because, you know, think about it this way. We started the morning with this heavy question. How do I know who I am? And we've walked through how Jesus answers the question. He does not give a go and do all of these very specific things likewise. No, it's open-ended. How do I know who I am? When the scripts conflict, when the labels fall away, how do you verify your identity? How do I verify, justify my identity? Look, it is so easy. And the thing that we will so naturally do is begin to point to our labels, point to our certificates. We're going to say, like, hey, I'm a generous person. But if we look at the calendar and the bank account, does the noun match the verb? We're going to say, I'm a forgiving person. Are we actually doing the grueling work of releasing the debts of people who have hurt us? Does the noun match the verb? We say, I am a follower of Jesus, but does the reflex we have, does it look more like the priest or the Samaritan crossing the street? Listen, I wrestle with this every day. It's easy for me, just talk about me for a second. It's easy for me to let the labels, the certificates, the titles do the heavy lifting for my identity. Well, I got a couple badges of honor I can put on. Like I have the Air Force officer uniform that I can put on. That label's right there on my chest. I walk into a room, everybody can see what it is. Stand up here as a pastor. Those labels carry weight. They mean something. But if for a moment I'm able to strip away the uniform, step down from the pulpit, I mean, the reality is so much messier than the projection I'd like to get across. Like I claim the label husband, but if you saw the truth, you saw the guy who sometimes pretends to be asleep so Courtney can handle the middle of the night crisis with the kids. And you would see how quickly I abandon the verb. I claim the label dad. I wear that badge with honor, but I lose my temper with the kids this morning. I claim the label pastor, but I'm often just as scared of the things that I tell you, hey, you do not need to be afraid about that. God holds the future. How often am I just as scared of that? This is what I'm talking about. The temptation to hide in the fortress of a respected label is a battle I fight every single day, because when the moment comes to actually live that identity, to live the verb, to sacrifice my sleep, to choose patience, to sit in messy pain with someone else when I've got a myriad of other things I need to be doing at that time, my reflex, what I don't want you to know is that my reflex is like the priest. With perfectly justifiable reasons why I need to be there and can't stop right now. See, I've wrestled with this all week. Jesus is using this story to hold it up like a mirror to us today. Looking in that mirror is weighty, and it's uncomfortable to realize how often I claim the inheritance of my father, but I refuse to do the work of my father. This is where I think the movie lands so beautifully. If you've seen this, you know that at the end of the film, there's another significant departure from the superhero trope. At the end of the film, Superman doesn't just like knock out the bad guy. He doesn't strike the heroic pose and declare that, hey, everything's figured out. I'm here. You don't need to worry anymore. No, he has this deeply reflective monologue at the end of the film, where he essentially admits that being a hero, rejecting the conqueror script and choosing to actually be human, he's like, this is not this one-time decision. It's not this easy, effortless reality that it just happens. He says it this way. He says, I'm as human as anyone. I love, I get scared, I wake up every morning, and despite not knowing what to do, I put one foot in front of the other and try and make the best choices I can. I screw up all the time, but that's what it means to be human. And I love the way that that's written at the end of the movie. I love that quote. It is so incredibly honest. I mean, there's something that it perfectly captures the human experience. Honestly, it captures the Christian experience. Like a daily struggle, putting one foot in front of the other. And yet I will say, while I loved that that's the way the Superman story ended, I'm so glad that that's not the way the Christian story ends. Because if that were the end, if all we have is our own, you know, effort, right? If the message is essentially do better and try harder. If all we have is our own effort to make it through make the best choices and on our own carry the weight of our screw ups, I mean, we will eventually be crushed by that. But you see, this is where the message of Jesus steps in to complete the picture. Think about the man in the ditch in Jesus' story. He is beaten. He is broken. He is completely incapable of doing anything for himself. He's left there half dead. Friends, do you understand that the central claim of the Christian story is that at our core, we are not the priest, the Levite, or the Samaritan. We are the one in the ditch. We are first the ones who couldn't keep the vows. We are first the ones who couldn't live up to the labels, who couldn't have any label. We are broken by our own choices, the sheer weight of the world, but the broadly the scriptures describe as sin and brokenness. And yet Jesus didn't just shout instructions to us from the safe side of the road. No, he became our ultimate Samaritan. He is the one who first crossed the street to us. He allowed himself to be crushed to pay our debt and bind our wounds. But you see, Jesus doesn't heal you. He doesn't just to pull you out of the ditch so that we can safely sit on the curb holding a new ticket called forgiven, that we're in, we're good. No, he heals us so that we can get back on our feet and walk the road with him. See, his grace, listen, his grace does not replace our effort. It is the engine that drives it. When we realize the lengths to which God went to rescue, when we realize that our status is secure, not because of our flawless resume, but because of his radical love that he has first showed us in the gospel, it fundamentally changes our nature and the way we live and be in our communities. The freeing thing about the Christian story is Jesus is unfolding this for us, is that we no longer have to frantically love our neighbor enough to earn our spot in the kingdom. The anxiety of proving ourselves like the lawyer is desperate to do is gone. Instead, in Jesus, you and I are finally free to love our neighbor because we are operating out of the love that we have already received. We can cross the street for others because he first crossed the street for us. And living out that identity, as for actually keeping those vows. Listen, I think Superman's monologue is spot on there. It takes tremendous effort. It is a daily walk, a daily work in progress. You will wake up tomorrow morning loving Jesus in as just as much need as his grace tomorrow as you were today and the day before that. We will wake up just like Superman said, getting scared and not always knowing what to do. And you will have a choice. I will have a choice. All over again. Whether I'm going to hide behind the fortress of my labels or step out onto the road. Now, before we go on to the rest of our week and you're done listening to some millennial rant about this stuff, I think Jesus invites us to pause. You see, we cannot do what he asks of us until we remember, reflect, and celebrate what he has done for us. So this morning, as we close together, we're going to come to reflect and remember the story of Jesus' work on our behalf by celebrating communion. Sometimes this is called the Lord's Supper. And you envision this as a family meal. If you walked in here today and are a follower of Jesus, this moment is for you. If you didn't grab one of the communion elements on the back on your way in, just raise your hand and we will get one to you. If you're here today just thinking about Christianity, not sure what you believe about Jesus, we'd ask that you not participate in this part. But for those of us who are following Jesus, remember, the table, this meal that we share, is a physical reminder of what it cost the ultimate Samaritan to cross the street for us. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, the Apostle Paul says it this way, "For I received from the Lord what I also delivered to you, that the Lord Jesus, on the night when he was betrayed, he took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, 'This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me.'" If you have the elements with you, I want you to take that bread. And as you hold it, remember the one who has stepped into the dirt with you, the mess with you. He allowed his body to be crushed so that your wounds and my wounds could be bound up. Let's eat the bread together, remembering Jesus' body broken for us. And Paul continues, he says this, "In the same way, Jesus also took the cup after supper, saying, 'This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this as often as you drink it in remembrance of me. For as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes." Friends, let's take the cup. And this is the reminder that he didn't just pay a couple of coins to an innkeeper, but he paid the ultimate price. He gave his life to secure our identity. Let's drink the cup together, remembering his blood that washes away the stain of our sin. Invite you to close your eyes for a moment. Because he first crossed the street for us. We are now free and empowered to do the same for others. Friends, as we go from this place, let his grace be the engine that drives our effort this week. Remember, grace is not opposed to effort. It's opposed to earning. So for a moment, I want you to imagine yourself in this story we've been reflecting on today. And the invitation that Jesus had for the lawyer is the same invitation he has for us. To look at our life, to look at the people in our path, and know that we have the choice to hide behind the safety of our labels, or we can look at the one who crossed the street for us. And he looks to us, and we see the true Samaritan and hear the words, "Go and do likewise." Father, we pray that you would continue to speak to us long after we leave this place. Continue to pierce us to the heart. Do what only you can do by the Holy Spirit. Prophetically step on our toes where we need that. As a wounded healer, would you first bind our wounds to make us whole in the gospel? We're grateful for your kindness and the compassion that you have first shown us. So would you send us now to go and do likewise? Stand and close in song today.